Twitter isn't just a medium for exchanging URLs and shopping tips or telling your friends what you had for lunch. As our linguist Jeff Nunberg observes, it's also given rise to an outpouring of haiku.
Sun Microsystems' Jonathan Schwartz was a thoroughly modern CEO, the first to have a blog. So when he resigned recently, after the company was acquired by Oracle, he didn't simply tweet the news. He put it in the form of a haiku. Financial crisis, stall too many customers, CEO no more. Schwartz had both thumbs on the pulse of the medium. Haiku are like amaryllis. They thrive in close quarters. And with its 140-character limit, Twitter is blooming with haiku, or twaiku as some call them. There are Twitter feeds for NASCAR haiku, cat haiku, zombie haiku, and user interface haiku. There are haiku competitions and campaigns. Jimmy Kimmel offered tickets to his show to whoever tweeted in the best haiku about the final episode of Lost. The British Rail Company asked passengers to tweet their haiku on the theme of the London summer, a topic that's nicely suited to a poem of three short lines. And after Glenn Beck said recently that churches were using the phrase social justice as a code for Nazism and communism, the organization Jewish Funds for Justice urged supporters to flood Beck's Twitter account with haikus of protest. Sarah Silverman offered this response: churches and their code, it's like when they say bless you, and yet no one sneezed. Of course, people were writing haiku in English long before Twitter came on the scene. In 1914, Ezra Pound made the haiku the model for his famous 14-word poem, In a Station of the Metro. The apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough. Ever since then, serious poets have been trying to adapt the features of the haiku to English, its economy, its chiseled syntax, and its juxtapositions of images. But not many have paid attention to the idea that a haiku should have exactly 17 syllables. In fact, Japanese haiku can have fewer than that, depending on the length of the vowels. But the haiku on Twitter don't often reveal a debt to Pound or Kerouac or Robert Hass, much less to Basho. For most people, the appeal of the haiku is precisely that it isn't weighted by tradition, so that you can take it wherever you like. Most are humorous and satirical, but they can also be lyrical, wistful, or serene. In the paint-by-numbers version of the form that most of us learned, there's really only one absolute constraint, that very rule of 17 that poets tend to disregard. That's what makes haiku so easy to write. You don't have to worry about rhyme or alliteration or meter. You can put the stresses and breaks anywhere, as long as the syllable count comes in on target. First you tick off 5, then 7, and then 5 more. Hey, there goes one now. It's only when you look at the outpouring of haiku on Twitter that you realize how pervasive they've become. They've completely filled the cultural space that was once occupied by light verse. Not that you can't find people posting that on Twitter, too. If you make strategic use of abbreviations, you can get a limerick down to exactly 140 characters, what people call a perfect touche. But compared to the flood of haiku, the light verse is just a trickle. It's a specialized taste these days. It survives in the crannies of culture alongside of charades and jigsaw puzzles. It's become a kind of fusty shtick. It conjures up the voices of Carl Castle and Charles Osgood. There are still skillful practitioners like Calvin Trillin in The Nation. But to judge from the verse that shows up on websites and Twitter, most people don't have the hang of writing it, not even the poets and professors. But that was inevitable once we lost our feel for the traditional rhythms that light verse has always drawn on. There was a young lady from Spain, ta-tum-ta-da-tum-ta-da-tum. The anapestic cadences of the limerick are the same ones children used to learn from reciting Browning, Scott, and Tennyson. Oh, well for the fisherman's boy that he shouts with his sister at play. But children aren't steeped in those poems anymore. The only anapestic poems that everyone still knows are The Night Before Christmas and Horton Hatches the Egg. Well, those and The Star-Spangled Banner. I feel very wistful about this. I grew up listening to my dad read the poems of Peter DeVries, E.B. White, and Phyllis McGinley that appeared in The New Yorker every week, before the editors decided that light verse was beneath the magazine's dignity. But that eclipse was first set in motion long ago, when poetry and verse went their separate ways with the advent of modernism. Actually, at just about the time Pound was discovering the haiku. And if the reams of haiku on Twitter aren't exactly verse, they're still poetry. people making their thoughts conform to a fixed formal pattern. And every now and then, you run into a haiku where someone's come up with an ingenious or surprising way to work that union of meaning and form. Just like light verse, that is, the haiku gives you a chance to be clever. That's a dismissive word to use for a serious poem, but it's the highest tribute you can pay to a playful one.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. You can find links to every Twitter feed Jeff mentioned on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also add your own haiku to the comment section of our website.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Think back a little bit to your younger years. Did you have some trinket, some cheap plastic or rubber toy that somehow absorbed all of your attention? Well, a lot of kids today are all about their silly bands. I happen to have one of these kids in my own house, Michelle.
Yeah, I've got one too. She adorns herself both wrists.
Lots of silly bands. That's silly bands with a Z. These are skinny rubber bracelets in all kinds of colors and shapes, cats, princesses, shields. NPR's Carolyn Beeler has been trying to figure out what makes the simplest toys into must-haves.
It's recess at Lafayette Elementary in Washington, D.C.
Who wants a pink parrot?
Several kids, mostly third and fourth graders, are sitting cross-legged around some silly bands that are scattered on the blacktop.
Does anybody want anything for this?
The vibe in their circle is a bit like the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange.
I think the most popular are limousines, I think because they're really rare or something.
9-year-old Grace Neville is wearing bands halfway up to her elbows. Pinks and oranges on one wrist, greens on the other. She says this is what recess is always like, at least since about last week. That's when one girl in her class showed up with the bracelets.
Tons of people were like, oh my gosh, I have to buy them. Where do you get them?
There is that moment in the lifespan of any fad. It's when everyone realizes that they must have the toy that a classmate just brought to the playground. Rohit Bhargava is a marketing executive at Ogilvy, a public relations firm. He says figuring out what makes that moment happen is impossible.
The way things take off for kids are sometimes completely unexpected and unexplained, and if I had the code for it, I think I'd probably be a bazillionaire by now.
Many different suppliers sell virtually identical bands. They all have different brand names, but most kids call them all silly bands. A Toledo, Ohio company called BCP Imports has a trademark on that name. The number of employees at their main office shot from about 20 last year to almost 70 today. In the last month alone, they've added 20 phone lines to take all the orders they've been getting. Rohit Bhargava says the craze provides an interesting case study in what would make the perfect fad. First, it must be portable.
It would have to be something that could exist out of the home. Part of the important thing with this trend was that it was something that you could wear to school. Some kids started doing it and you saw it and you wanted to be part of it.
Second, he says, you have to have an incentive to keep buying them.
Silly bands are not something that you would just buy once. Kids buy them over and over in different shapes, and it's not just a one-time thing.
Third, it helps if you can trade them. Third grader Grace Neville says trading keeps a trend fresh.
Usually if you want, you can always trade, and nothing is old, nothing becomes old.
Finally, Rohit Bhargava says a good fad makes you feel like you're part of something.
It seems weird to connect silly bands with a community, but it's such a visible thing that all these kids are wearing on their arms and can see one another wearing that it really does give you a sense of belonging to something.
And it doesn't hurt when the trend appeals to both boys and girls and kids of all different ages. At a toy store in Washington, D.C., kids from toddlers up to teenagers have steadily surrounded the rack where the silly bands hang. But what exactly do you do with the bands after you buy them? Fifth grader Sarah Birch doesn't really know.
That's the thing, not much. You just kind of have them, trade them, they look cool, but there's not really a point to them.
It isn't rational, she says, but it's just what you do when you're a kid. Carolyn Beeler, NPR News, Washington.
As soon as the spill began, BP started reaching out to Americans over the internet. It's been posting videos of the cleanup on its YouTube channel, and it's using Facebook and Twitter to post links to news stories and updates on the spill. NPR's Carolyn Beeler reports on whether or not BP's social media campaign is working.
A video on BP's YouTube channel shows a company vice president standing on a sandy beach. Workers in the background clean along the shoreline with shovels and garbage bags.
We have 25,000 people. They're working in 5 different states. And all of this has happened over 8 weeks.
The video is one of dozens that highlights BP's response efforts. Sites like YouTube and Facebook have allowed the company to communicate directly with the public. Crisis management expert Chris Lehane says BP has been good about putting information where people can get it whenever they want.
I think they did a very good job identifying the communication outlets that exist in the new digital world. But I think they have fallen into the age-old crisis 101 do-not-do list, which is to rush out information, which has turned out not to be accurate.
Lehane says with so many new places to put information, companies can feel a lot of pressure to get their message out fast in times of crisis. A BP spokesman says that's not what's happening at his company. He says it puts the same information on its social media sites that it releases to the traditional media, like newspapers and TV. But to some, that's the real flaw in BP's strategy. Jeff Livingston runs a social media marketing company. He says when he looks at the BP America Facebook page, he sees a company talking at people.
So if we look at BP America's Facebook page, all right, this is an interesting one. So I'm looking.
Livingston says BP is just messaging people. That's fine for an ad campaign, but it doesn't work well on Facebook, where people expect a dialogue.
So when you have a two-way channel like Facebook or Twitter, you're expected to have a conversation. And eventually, when you don't have a conversation with people and you just put out messages and ignore them, people feel like you're not really there.
Katie Oliver lives nowhere near the Gulf. Still, the Wisconsin resident wants to learn more about the disaster, find ways to help, and express her frustrations. She posted a message on the BP Facebook page telling the company to pay up, clean up, and get out. But she says she's more drawn to sites like the Boycott BP page. The tone is negative on these anti-BP sites, but at least they're telling her something she can do.
People want to be a part of something, and I think that's why the anti ones are going to have more of an effect on people.
There are Facebook pages that support BP, but most tap into the public's anger. An anonymous user set up a fake BP Twitter account under the official sounding name BP Global PR. Here's a recent post. If you must cry over this oil spill, please don't do it in the Gulf. Saltwater ruins our oil. That fake Twitter account has 10 times more followers than BP's official Twitter stream. Carolyn Beeler, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR.